Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Welcome to a special episode of the Late Night with Seth Meyers podcast. Today you'll hear an exclusive interview between the HE Band's Eli Janney and the band Interpol, recorded when they recently visited Studio AG. They talk about coming up in the New York music scene together, as well as Interpol's new album, Marauder. Now let's go to Eli Janney and Interpol.
Hello, everybody. My name's Eli Janney. I'm from the HE Band. Today, our guests are an indie rock group from New York made famous with their seminal release, Turn on the Bright Lights, in 2002, becoming one of the biggest bands of the 2000s. I'm sure you love hearing that. They are sitting in with us today to discuss their sixth record, Marauder, and share some thoughts on staying creative for 20 years. We have Interpol here. Paul, hello.
Hi there.
Sam, our buddy.
Hello, Eli.
Sam sat in with the band.
That's right.
Daniel.
How's it going there?
The man. Let's start with some basics here. This will be your 20th year, 21st year together.
This is the 20th year of the band. Sam joined in 2000, but we played our first show.
It's only been 18 years for you.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, it's been only been 18.
Only.
You know, I wonder about the how I missed the first two, what that does for the whole.
We were christened in 2000.
I know, it's kind of
the whole enterprise here.
Now when you tour, when you're 20 years later, 20 years older, do you feel the same sort of excitement for the shows, the same sort of connection with the audience?
I do. I really do. I feel like way more comfortable too. I think I can enjoy the moment a lot more. I think I appreciate the moment much more now than I probably even did in the early days, even maybe in around Bright Lights. It wasn't like I didn't appreciate it, but you know, it was happening so fast. It was all so new and so forth. But now it's more like, wow, this is incredible. Like, you know, you play music and these people have this reaction to it, something that you wrote not that long ago and this and that. You know, it's really, you can boil it down and make it very, very simple. And at the end of the day, I think it's a really remarkable thing, so I really appreciate it. I really still love
it. I think that's an interesting comment, though, that you appreciate it more now with the years.
Confidence.
Confidence?
You know, you build a way to do it, and you feel good about it. You're not questioning yourself.
That's
and,
true.
You know, back then, it was just, here it is.
Yeah.
And you're just throwing it up on the wall to see it ever lick it off, you know?
Yeah.
And now when you're, you know, it's like, there's people that, like, make plans to come and see us play.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
they save
true.
Money, and I don't know. I think it would shortchange them if you walked out kind of nervous and unsure.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
So you don't get nervous anymore?
I still do, but it's out of it's anticipation. Like, I'd rather just be playing all the time.
Yeah.
The way to get rid of my nerves would just be to put me up there and wind me up.
Yeah.
It's always beforehand where that anticipation. I hate it.
Yeah.
I hate the last 3 minutes. Of waiting before,
right,
whether
before.
It's to go on a show here or to go on stage. Yeah.
This is your sixth studio album, right?
Yes.
How do you stay inspired to keep creating? Like, do you ever get tired?
I think that collaboration makes it easier to stay creative because it's not, you know, your creative responsibility to kind of do everything. And so I feel like a lot of making art or music, it's like kind of bouncing ideas off of each other and reacting to things that the other people are presenting. I don't know. I feel like the band is kind of like a conversation, and we're all sort of bringing different things to the conversation as time goes on, but we're all still interested in having that conversation. It's still kind of like snappy among us. So that's, you know, I think if you're like a solo artist who just does everything, it's probably more of a burden on you creatively. But when you get to enjoy sort of like, oh, that's a cool riff, you know, let's mess around with that, it makes it a lot easier.
How do you write this stuff now? Are you writing? I know that you had a practice space. I'm going to ask about that later. But you guys get into a room and just jam it out the same as you did, you know, 20 years ago?
It's the same. Daniel brings in songs on guitar, and we sort of sit with that batch of songs and build them out to Interpol material.
How do you decide when this is a record and this is time to make a record?
I think it just kind of like, it just starts to show a little bit, sort of, right? Like, it's sort of, I think first and foremost, I think for us that she'd be on the road to making a new record or whatever, it just has to be, things need to be working in the room. It's never like, well, there's going to be a new record. I think it's in the room, and all of a sudden, like, for the batch of songs from Marauder, it was just, you know, we started out and obviously we had a blank slate, but pretty quickly, you know, things were rolling and it was exciting, you know? Yeah. Like, everything, the songs were getting really exciting, and I think we're walking out like, oh, man, that sounded great. Or, you know, there was, like, a few of those, and they start building, and then you start gaining momentum, being like, we're kind of on our way to just starting to write a new record, you know? And then after a while, I think when you get to, like, probably, like, having seven songs that have somewhat of an identity. Paul's done an incredible job too with, in the last couple of records, just singing right from the beginning of, you know, since he writes the bass parts, he's basically setting up with, you know, a bass setup and a vocal mic. And he's, I have to say, for every single song, while he's exploring bass ideas, just even initially, he was exploring vocal ideas, you know, right away, and not afraid to just, you know, go down some roads and just try things out. But consequently, really, I think helped us to see that, like, you know, get a sense of the identity of these songs early on. But I think it's, you start realizing that these songs have a form and a bit of a beginning and an ending and an identity, especially if there's, you know, vocals happening and so forth. You get a sense that, like, we're, you know, it's time to make start making plans about where you want to make the record, how you want to do it, and so forth.
When you're doing the vocal ideas, are you doing lyrics at the same time? I remember Scott used to have books of lyrics that he would always be scribbling. And as we were writing, he would kind of flip through them like, oh, this phrase would fit in that. So we were talking about Brainiac before. And the way that Tim did it was he would just sing nonsense syllables over the song and then later listen to it and said, that sounds like this words. And then he would fit words that on top of those syllables. It's super weird.
That's more my approach. And I had tried originally, you know, I used to like write poetry and just sort of like I would just write. And I tried early on to kind of insert good lyrics that I had into Interpol songs, and it wasn't satisfactory to me. And I think people can get away with that, but I prefer having the words intersect very specifically and interact with the drums and the hi-hat pattern and the bass accents. That's more important to me than sort of shoehorning in a good lyric. So I do exactly what the Brainiac guy did, which is I sing fake words. And then what's interesting is you get more dialed into that and you realize that, I think because of the way that like language patterns work in your brain, those words that you think want to be there, that you're approximating with vague syllables, like there are words from your subconscious that want to be there, and they can be translated and they do make sense, which is the weirdest part. And I think it's something I've gotten better at doing, which is sort of figuring out what the fake words want to be. I can get there quicker now. So in some of the songs, I would come up with the melody and a lyric instantly, but 95% of the time, it's just, I'm just worrying about cadence and melody, and I'll figure out the words later.
Is that a process where, because you've been doing it for so many records, and it probably helps collaborating with other people, especially other styles, that you can relax your mind and a little bit and not worry so much about, you know, specific lyrical ideas. And when those syllables come out, that allows you to get that subconscious ideas down on paper?
I think the practice has helped a lot. And I think some of the collaborations I've done have helped me become what Daniel was mentioning about sort of, I do the vocals sooner. I think working with RZA, I got like a less precious about the vocals, because it's sort of, I think in Interpol, I used to really just enjoy us finding what the song was, and I'd sort of wait for the vocal. And I kind of realized, like, that's less fun for my bandmates to, like, wait for the vocal. And it's now I just, like, kind of push it and just say, like, F it, you know, do the vocal now.
It's really helpful, though.
Yeah.
It's really, it helps the identity. You're informing the whole arrangement straight away. Yeah. It's hard when you arrange something and you feel like, especially rhythmically, it's one thing and then a vocal comes in and things might not. And just to have either person to have to kind of rearrange, you know, what they were doing for a long time takes the steam out of it. But just to have these certain parameters, like, straight away, especially for me, like, it's kind of fun to be involved right from minute one. But when you're not actually writing any music, sometimes it could be, like, the most boring thing ever. But, like, when Paul will start singing and, you know, tells me what's going on and it kind of informs me, it, like, wholly redirects, like, what my true intention should be.
There's a couple instances on the new record, like Surveillance was sort of like an old type of Interpol song where it's just like, but in spite of me not being Precious anymore and just saying go for it vocally, sometimes I just don't have anything and I'm really caught up in the instrumental of what we're doing. And so, like, a song like Surveillance, it wound up getting vocals, but not until, like, the studio. We would just play that one song down instrumental. And it's cool. I mean, you really nuance all the parts that way. But I think it is better if the song's going to end with a vocal, the sooner the vocal's in there, the better, I think, when you're writing songs.
Yeah, there's always exceptions. Like, I don't know if anybody's heard that, if they have the record to listen to Surveillance. There's a type of song, no matter what happens vocally, it's going to be fine. You know, but there are few and far between. You know, that this song in particular is kind of four on the floor, and dynamically, it just keeps going straight to the end.
I think people wouldn't have hated that song as an instrumental.
I think it'd be good.
Oh, that's interesting. Vocal, but I like, because cool. The vocal, I thought, is very rhythmic.
But then a song like If You Really Love Nothing, he had the vocal melody. He had that lyric from the first day, right, when, you know, it was just Paul and I playing. Like, it was like right away.
Do you ever find that you get to the, you're in the studio in that far along in that process and you just don't have lyrics?
I have.
I'm not saying that my singer ever did that, but
I feel like I've struggled so much over the years with lyrics, and then I think in recent years I've had the kind of epiphany of how to not struggle so much with it and just, like, do it, and I feel like the result is even better and much more easily attained. But I traditionally had loads of problems with last minute lyrics and lyrics that I was really, you know, just against the clock, and I'd done 1,000 ideas and stuff, and I feel like, I guess you just sort of, you do get strength from those struggles. But yeah, man, I've really agonized in the studio in the past. On this album, if I had a problem with the vocal, I already had, like, a couple other choices that were in this book. I had a book for this record that I just worked a lot on.
When you guys toured on Turn on the Bright Lights, which is one of my favorite records of all time, just on a personal note, Girls Against Boys had been touring for 10 years, and I was really, really burnt out on just the music industry and everything in general. And that record came out, and I was just, like, fell in love with it. And I was like, music is great. Yes. Has your view of this album as an accomplishment changed in your mind at all? Like, I know that it kind of exploded right at the beginning. And did you ever go through a period where you were kind of sick of it and now you've come back to it, or just was it always one of your favorites?
I personally never got, like, sick of it at all. I just kind of, I never wanted to be one of those bands that sort of distances or, like, you know, does things just for the audience wants, if it sort of rolls our eyes. I kind of always wanted to be like, no, I think even making that record, I wanted, even though we had, like, we were really short on time, short on budget and so forth, I kind of wanted it to be like, I wanted to be good with it forever. You know what I mean? I mean, we waited so long to actually get to make a record. So, like, almost like 5 years, and here we are finally doing it. Sort of like, wait, you know, I kind of, you know, you want to make sure you're happy with it. So I'm definitely not sick of it. It was a nice thing to go do. It just happened to be the 15-year anniversary. We've never toured, like, in between record cycles, and we were, like, deep writing the songs of Ian Marauder, and it came up as an idea, and we all kind of were like, that sounds like fun to go do, you know, a month in Europe, and then handful shows in the States and Mexico, and it was fun. I don't know if it really informed anything for Marauder because those songs were so far along, but it was humbling to see, like, how people have been, you know anticipating us doing something like this and expecting it, and they're, you know, being kind of emotional at times while we're playing that record. So And also at the same time, there's a bit of pressure on you to be like, okay, well, we hope we deliver the experience that you're hoping, you know, that you're expecting.
Yeah. You want to do a great job to present those songs. As far as being identified with like early 2000s music, you know, with the book Meet Me in the Bathroom and stuff like that, is this your kinship with like the Strokes and the Walkmen and the Liars? Was at that time when you were doing it in those early 2000s, did you feel like this was your scene and that you belonged in that scene? Or is this something that grew over time?
I remember our former bass player, Carlos, would flip out if we weren't kind of associated on some top five cool thing. And I used to think to myself, like, when all those bands are not cool anymore, there's not going to be anything. And it's better to, like, if there's a light association with something as a springboard, that's great, it worked. But then you want to distance yourself because then you have the chance of longevity and to identify. You just don't want to be caught in the scene of the 2000s.
Right.
And I think we struck the right balance to have enough of that to garner some attention, but then we took it from there.
The scene thing was always just a handy angle. I mean, even when we were first coming out, people would sort of say, you know, they wanted so desperately for us to be like, yeah, us and the Strokes and the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, we all hang out at the same bar and we do drinking games and it's and listen to records together, you know, and it just wasn't that. But at the same time, we were a rock band in New York City, and so there was a rock scene. So it's true that we were all part of a scene. But I think it's we've just kind of been focusing on what we do. I think we were all pretty big fans at the time of the Walkmen and Liars. Like, I would go to their shows. We played quite a few shows with Walkmen. The Strokes was funny. Like, they blew up before I even was aware of them. Like, I didn't catch any of their early gigs before they became international.
Mm-hmm.
The British press told me about the Strokes.
Yeah, me too. I was like, who are these guys? Yeah.
The British press told everybody about New York. We were involved before we put a record out. We were involved in this big NME feature, and the cover on the magazine was We Heart New York. And it was just like,
I remember
Moldy
that.
Peaches, The Strokes, ARE Weapon.
I remember
Yeah. I mean, it was just kind of outlining for the traveler.
And I don't want to seem cynical. I love it. I'm super proud to be associated with those bands. And like, I love the fact that we're part of the New York rock resurgence and yada yada. It's all great. It's just that the scene for me was like, we're in a band trying to be the best band we can. And that was sort of my focus.
Yeah. Yeah. The Yeah Yeah Yeahs, their first tour was opening for Girls Against Boys.
Oh, wow.
First of three, actually. That was their, and we did this thing where we were going out to South by Southwest, and you know, you got to book it really early because everybody's trying to do that.
Yep.
So we're going out there, and it's the Yeah Yeahs are first, and I think French Kicks were in the middle, and then us. And then by the time we had come back to the East Coast, they were way bigger than us. Like,
we you know, you weren't part of it. We played shows of Girls Against Boys for Turn on the Bright Lights in France. And I don't know if we went to any other countries.
The reason why I didn't go is because my wife was pregnant with our second child and she was having complications. And the last minute, it was like 2 weeks to go.
Oh, no way.
And the doctor was like, she might have to stay on bed rest, which means that she can't get out of bed. Yeah, and so I was like, I can't go. I'm so sad to have missed that. Last but not least, let's talk about this record, Marauder. This record has kind of a much rawer feel than you've had on a lot of things. Is that coming out of the practice space kind of vibe, or was that something that Dave Fridman had suggested?
I think it's something he recognized.
Okay.
Coming out of the practice space. And, you know, we'd always demo the stuff in a pretty crude manner just to get it. We weren't recording, we're writing music. I kept it really simple just because I wanted him to hear, not production ideas, the songs. And somehow that became, not template, but like basis, the springboard, where, you know, he kind of just took that and did his Fridman thing with these very pretty straightforward approaches sonically, you know, or aesthetically.
Yeah, it's interesting because it oddly has a much more intimate feel. It feels more like you guys playing in live or playing in a rehearsal space.
I think he heard these demos that we're recording Sam did of our rehearsals and sort of realized, like, you got these songs are pretty complete and you can play them.
Yeah.
And I think that was what made him inspired to say, why don't we just go straight to tape because you can play these songs. As opposed to sort of like, you know, doing lots and lots of passes, overdubs. Yeah. And so I think that was maybe the start of this idea of just keeping it really stripped down. But then as we've been writing the record, we often talked about like not wanting to overproduce this one and just like keep it to like what we can create here. Let's translate that on a record. So I think a few factors and a few kind of attitudes fed into the result being sort of, I think it's like, yeah, lean and raw and sort of minimal.
It's really
and lively.
Cool.
And lively. Lively. Like in the rehearsal room, it was like really lively, just bouncing off the walls and the, you know, we were sharing the AES space, then we had to go to the music building, which, for those who don't know, is a building and that still exists in New York City, so thank God for that.
Unbelievably, it still exists.
It still exists, and but there, it's just like, I don't know, 12 floors, no, maybe more, like 14 floors of just like bands and rehearsal spaces, so...
It's the noisiest building in New York City.
The success of like any band that moves to New York City or you know is a band in New York City knows to find like a place where you're not going to hear any outside exterior sounds is almost impossible. So the way to do that is actually just to play. And so, you know, I think that does actually sort of influence the music somewhat.
Yeah, we had a space in there for a few years with Skeleton Key. Remember that?
Oh, my God. Wow. Yeah.
I saw them.
Eric was the guy from Skeleton Key.
And
right?
Rick Lee had like his Jack collection Matt's of like junk that he would use as percussion just all over the place.
I just want to say, too, though, that the, you know, Girls Against Boys was a really big influence for me. And
thanks, man.
You know, Venus Looks Sure and Cruise Yourself were like huge records. I listened to them to death.
It's funny because when people, you know, like I said, and people say, turn on the bright lights. That's like your, you know, your signature record, whatever. And people say, Venus Looks Sure, that's your signature record. I was like, it is, I guess so.
I love
six records. But I have to say, I really love the sound of this new record because of that. Because it sounds like it really does sound like you guys are playing together. Like, I think that Dave did a great job capturing that moment.
Cool.
Well, thank you so much for this. Congratulations on the new record, and we'll see you on the show tonight.
Sounds great.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding in your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.